What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Look, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary is Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Luke Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison? Swangles in Fort Lauderdale.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Hello, everybody. My name's Charlie Robinson, and I hope you can hear my words clearly, because in this episode, we're going to focus on words and how they are used to divide us. I have a good friend named Benny Wills from Joy Camp. He has a podcast called Words, 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 and part of the reason is because he's an actor and he's a poet, and he uses his words to paint a picture to describe what's going on. And I would say that clearly we have this happen every day when we turn on our mainstream news. We hear words, 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 but what do they really mean? Benjamin Disraeli, who was this former British Prime Minister, said, "The wisdom of the wise and the experience of the ages are perpetuated by quotations." It's part of the reason why I put so many quotations in the book, was because it felt like it did sort of punctuate what people were saying and give you an idea to hear the way they were thinking and how they were framing their reality. You know, it's important, I think, to hear the words spoken by the people that were actually involved in some of these amazing and pivotal events in human history. And but we have a strange tendency to sort of believe the first story that we hear. If you turn on the nightly news and there's been a shooting, for example, the first story that they tell, the narrative, is that becomes the official story. And then every story after that is saddled with the responsibility of trying to knock the official story down. If you think of it like in the Olympics, when you've got downhill skiing as an event, you know, the first person that goes down the run, their score is number one, right? Their time is number one. And then every racer that goes after them has to run their race, and hopefully their time is better, and then it'll knock it down. But it's a weird thing that we do in the United States, especially, is we just blindly believe the first story we're told. We blindly say that the first skier that went down the hill won the race. In actuality, it's not the way it is. The first story is always disjointed. And if it's coming to you from the mainstream media, it's usually a lie or partially a lie. It definitely has an agenda tied to it. And then if you come along and propose an alternative version of that story, inevitably you will be looked at as the maniac who's just, you know, conspiracy theorist or something along those lines, when you're simply presenting a much more logical story than the official one. And so the control of words is important. It's clearly it's important. I mean, it's been for thousands of years. You go back to magic and magic spells and things like that, and the art of language. Some languages are propped up, some are suppressed, some books are suppressed. We know about the Nazi book burning and things like that. I mean, words and language are important. They're a form of our history. And the people that are trying to control those words or prevent you from using certain words, you know, they've got a term for them, cultural Marxist. Anyone that's trying to tell you that you're not allowed to say a certain word is, you have to be suspect of them because, you know, what is their purpose for that? Are they trying to protect someone's feelings? Okay, fine. You don't want to call people retarded because it's offensive to mentally handicapped people? Okay, I can maybe understand that. If you're calling a mentally handicapped person retarded, that's obviously a cruel thing to do. But if you're saying it to your friend in a joking way, and the thought police hear you and tell you you're not allowed to say that, well, why? I'm allowed to say whatever I want. None of your business. Mind your own business. So these words have been hijacked lately. We see it a lot, especially social justice warriors. Everybody's got a new word. There's a new word you can't say. You can't say this. Oh my God, if you say that, then how dare you? You know, you're a terrible person. Well, over the last 50 years, television has definitely been the first one to offer up the version of events. You know, something happens, you turn on your TV, you go there to find out what it is. And they toss out an explanation about what happened with a straight face, just like Garrick Utley did on 9/11 when he said, you know, in the rubble of Lower Manhattan, a hijacker's passport was found in the rubble, if you can believe that. No, we can't believe that. How fucking dare you try to pass that off as the reason? I mean, Garrick Utley could barely get the words out of his mouth. He had to throw in that, if you can believe that, because he couldn't believe that the words were actually coming out of his mouth. So let me get this straight, mainstream media. A hijacker that was on one of the flights that crashed into the Twin Towers and exploded in a huge fireball 110 stories above had his passport in his pocket. It flew out of his pocket. It flew out of a burning fireball. It flew out of an imploded building and landed several blocks away in great condition at the foot of an FBI agent. And you expect us to believe this? And the media wonders why nobody believes them anymore? I mean, come on. So there was a time when I was a kid when we would watch the nightly news and Tom Brokaw would be on, and you kind of picked your favorite news anchor and you're like, oh, I like Peter Jennings. Well, I like Tom Brokaw. For whatever reason, we watched NBC News and Tom Brokaw. And my default was to believe them. I was a kid, but to believe them because why would they be lying to us? And I think a lot of people felt that way. I think the older generation right now feels that way. And their default is set to trusting the news. Well, that's changed for me, clearly, and I think for a lot of people. My default is set to not believe them until they prove it to me, which is, I think, the way it should be. I mean, I'm so extreme that I don't even trust the weather report when it comes on because it's coming from the mainstream news. And so, you know, so things have changed. We didn't just all wake up one day and decide we were going to not trust the mainstream media. This is a cumulative effect of decades and decades of lies, piled upon more lies, piled upon more lies. And then they throw out the hijacker passport thing. I'll tell you what, from now on, we should start building buildings out of the paper used in hijackers passports because apparently they're indestructible. I mean, this is... How dare you even come on national news and try to pass off that term? I mean, Garrett Utley is dead now. I'm sure he's rolling over in his grave for having, you know, the only way you make that statement is if your boss is holding one of your kids hostage, you know, off screen, off camera with a gun to their head. That's the only way you read that bullshit story about hijackers' passwords, but he did. And people believe that because we're trained and we're programmed to trust the words that come from the mainstream media. But maybe you've heard of the martial art form called judo. What judo is you use your opponent's weight and momentum against them in order to put them in a position to submit. So, you know, I feel like what we're doing now is verbal judo. We're using their words against them to make them submit. You know, it's verbal judo works really well on politicians because, you know, they're typically pretty arrogant. They think they're smarter than they really are. They talk way too much. But we can hang them with their own words, and in part because they tend to think that their words are more important than everybody else's. And also because, you know, they've screwed up this planet so badly that they deserve to be knocked down a couple pegs. So I don't have any problem using the words of politicians or high-ranking business people or lawyers that you see or political pundits or news anchors. I have no problem using their words against them to club them into submission. They deserve it. If they're lying, take their words, use it against them, and beat them down with it. Not physically, obviously. But it does create a bit of a problem. Reminds you of the Mark Twain quote, "Never argue with stupid people. They will drag you down to their level and then beat you with experience." And I think we've all had situations where that has happened, especially online. God knows Twitter is a haven for, you know, lowering yourself to argue with the morons, maybe even bots and definitely trolls. But you know, I think that when we're all talking about these important issues and we're getting off onto some fringe topics, it's important to realize that we're going to be wrong from time to time. It's inevitable. We don't like it. I don't like it, of course, but it's going to happen. And, you know, on these important events, you're talking about 9/11 and these, you know, the run-up to these big wars and Epstein and all these things, we are going up against professional disinformation agents, CIA-trained, MI6-trained, Mossad, you name it. As Mike Pompeo has even told you, we have classes on teaching us at CIA Academy, lie, cheat, and steal. So this is what's out there. The disinformation game is strong with these people, and we're going to be wrong from time to time. And that's okay. You know, we have to tell ourselves that as long as we're coming at this from the right place, you know, we're coming at this from a place of wanting to get the truth right and not necessarily fear-mongering, but spreading as accurate of information as we can about some crazy events, school shootings, mass shootings in public and things like that. You know, we're gonna get some of them wrong. And I think we have to acknowledge that, if for no other reason than to, you know, preserve our credibility. But as long as we come at this from the right angle, where we're using our words from a good place and not with the intention of deceiving people, then I think that we'll get a pass every now and then if we mess up a couple of the details, as long as our heart is in the right place. Bill Hicks had a great quote about people talking out, about people wanting to change the world. He said, "The world is like a ride in an amusement park. When you choose to go on it, you think it's real because that's how powerful our minds are. And the ride goes up and down and round. It has thrills and chills, and it's very brightly colored, and it's very loud, and it's fun for a while. Some people have been on the ride for a long time, and they begin to question, is this real, or is this just a ride? And other people have remembered, and they come back to us, they say, hey, don't worry. Don't be afraid ever. Because this is just a ride. And we kill those people. So obviously Hicks was making a joke because he's a comedian, or was a comedian. That's his job. But he's correct in saying that we kill those people. You know, the question is, why do we kill those people? Negative stories dominate our news headlines. It's like they say in the industry, if it bleeds, it leads. You know, Don Henley wrote a song about it back in the early 80s called Dirty Laundry. You know, I can tell you about the plane crash with the gleam in her eyes, you know, talking about that. It's interesting when people die. It is interesting when people die, as long as people aren't close to you. But he was making a point that in the news media, they get focused on the negative stories because the negative stories are more interesting to us. And there have been a few leaders that have tried to warn us, but it always ends up the same for them. They, you know, there's something about having your brains blown out in public that sends a very clear message to those fantasizing about, you know, rising up and blowing the whistle on the corrupted world that we live in. You know, how important is the truth? Are you willing to die for it? Most people have heard this quote from John F. Kennedy. This is from 1961. For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silenced, not praised. No expenditure is questioned, no rumor is printed, no secret is revealed. Now, history scholars will tell you that Kennedy's speech was talking about the spread of communism. You know, that, you know, maybe he wanted that as cover for, you know, to make it look like he was talking about communism, should anyone ever, you know, happen to question it. But you have to kind of read between the lines on that. He couldn't come right out and say, you know, the globalists that are running this planet are total lunatics and that they're going to get us all killed. But as much as we would have loved for him to say that, but even his predecessor, President Eisenhower, used his outgoing presidential speech a few weeks earlier to warn us about the consolidation of power within American government and certain segments of the private sector that he saw as a very real threat to the world. And Kennedy understood very clearly what Eisenhower was talking about, and it was something far worse than communism. It was the emergence of the New World Order. That's what he was really talking about. That's what Kennedy was really talking about. And that's what Eisenhower was talking about when he made this quote during that speech. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. Well, I mean, he didn't even try to disguise it there. And he would know, as one of the few five-star generals ever, that the military-industrial complex, as he put it, I would put that category, I would say / New World Order, were poised to start running the show. This was 1961 when he said that. He saw it during World War II. he witnessed it, him as running the European theater of war. And, you know, you've got to think back right now for a president to go on nightly news and, or, you know, talk about something. There's plenty of airtime available. Hell, there's Twitter, you know, Donald Trump tweets all kinds of crazy stuff. But back then in 1961, there's a very limited amount of time that a president actually spoke to the people. And to use and to use your outgoing presidential address and the time that the small amount of time that you had allotted to scream, you all need to be concerned about the undue amount of influence and power that the military-industrial complex has. I mean, well, maybe we should listen to him. You know, maybe we should listen to his words. He's telling you what is coming. As a guy that would know what's coming. 30 years later, George H.W. Bush would use his address to the nation to give a very different speech. We have, in this past year, made great progress in ending the long era of conflict and the Cold War. We have before us the opportunity to forge for ourselves and for future generations a new world order, a world where the rule of law, not the law of the jungle, governs the conduct of nations. When we are successful, and we will be, we have a real chance at this new world order, an order in which a credible United Nations can use its peacekeeping role to fulfill the promise and visions of the United Nations founders. Well, if you know anything about George H.W. Bush, you would know that he was a reprehensible human being, a hardcore pedophile, a Satanist, a fake war hero, awful president, definitely involved with the Kennedy assassination, definitely involved with the Reagan attempted assassination, and of course he kicked off the first Gulf War. But I mean, just listen to his words. I mean, just kind of examine them for a minute. A credible United Nations? Why did you have to say a credible United Nations? Are we supposed to think that they're uncredible? Incredible? I mean, for those of you that are unaware of what the United Nations is, the United Nations was started by the Rockefellers. It's a globalist regime. It's an organization that is not looking to unite nations. It's looking to build a one world government. So anything that United Nations is involved in, you should steer clear of. Be very wary of them. Do not donate money to them. Their charities are, fraudulent and phony, and everything that they say they're doing is inverted. So that's just kind of on a side note. But a new world order, huh? Well, what's wrong with the old world order? I guess that was the one where George H.W. Bush and his buddies weren't in charge of that. So they want the new world order, right? Where the Rockefellers can run it. I think that we'll pass on that. But lest you think that David Rockefeller is some sort of philanthropist, I would say more like full-on rapist. But let me read you this. This is from page 405 of his autobiography called Memoirs. It's almost unbelievable, but look, I mean, I'll just read it. For more than a century, ideological extremists at either end of the political spectrum have seized upon well-publicized incidents to attack the Rockefeller family for the inordinate influence they claim we wield over American political and economic institutions. Some even believe we are part of a secret cabal working against the best interests of the United States, characterizing my family and me as internationalists, and of conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated global political and economic structure, one world, if you will. If that's the charge, I stand guilty, and I am proud of it. I mean, I don't think he got misquoted in his autobiography. And the only person I know that got misquoted in their autobiography is Charles Barkley. So unless you're unless Charles Barkley wrote this for you, David Rockefeller, this is probably the truth of how he sees the world. He's an internationalist. He is a globalist, characterizing his family as one, conspiring with others around the world. He said, I stand guilty and I'm proud of that. So the words that these people said, you're not going to hear that on your nightly news. Are you out of your mind? You sit around and wait for Tom Brokaw to come on and say, oh, this is interesting from David Rockefeller. Let me read this to you. It'll never, ever, ever happen. That's why you've got to find these quotes. You've got to compile them yourself. You've got to dig them out, because if you're David Rockefeller, I mean, that's not going on your business card, I would think. Though he's past tense, he's dead. I don't normally gloat about people being dead, but I'm willing to make a special exception for old David Rockefeller. But, you know, what did Maya Angelou, is she the one that said, you know, when people show you who they are, believe them? Well, let's do the same with David Rockefeller and the Bushes and the Clintons and the Trumps and the Obamas and Tony Blair and all these guys. When they show you over and over again who they really are, I don't know, believe them. Have you ever heard the term problem, reaction, solution? David Icke has put that term forward quite a bit. What it means is that the people in positions of power will create a problem, manufacture a problem out of thin air, in order to stoke some sort of reaction from the public. Typically, the reaction is, oh my God, I can't believe this happened. We can never let this happen again. So that they can propose a solution. Problem, reaction, solution. Now, the solution is always something that the government had in plan for the people anyway, but just knew they couldn't pull off. They didn't have the support for it. But things change once you introduce a problem into the equation. Let's say you want to take away guns, right? What would you do? You'd create a big false flag shooting. Problem, there's a shooting. Reaction, oh my God, we got to stop these shootings with all these guns. Solution, let's come in and enact some sort of gun control legislation. There's hundreds of laws in the books, but they always want to add some more because the point is they don't want you, us, the people, to have guns if they can manage to get it away from us. And I'm not some gun lover, but I do understand that all of the mass slaughters that have happened, whether it's Mao in China or Hitler in Germany or Stalin in Russia or Pol Pot in Cambodia, all of those slaughters began with the disarming of the public. In fact, Mao has a quote that says, you know, you disarm the public before the slaughter. Yeah, I mean, I guess that's what you would do. So the government loves these problem, reaction, solution strategies. And as the public, we haven't been really wise to this for a very long time. It's starting to change. I think people are starting to kind of wake up to this, especially in the alternative media. A lot of us are, you know, we'll see these shootings in particular where somebody, where the story doesn't add up. You know, the parts of the story are very disjointed, and almost immediately you start to hear calls for gun control, and you're like, oh well, you know, I could see this coming. I could call this a mile away. But there's another term for it. It's called the Hegelian dialectic. All right, that's the original problem, reaction, solution. So, to define the Hegelian dialectic method simply, the ruling body must first trigger a problem or a crisis that causes the citizens to react with fear and demand a solution. The rulers then offer a solution, which they had already predetermined before the crisis even started. And the solution usually entails more power for the elites and less freedom for the citizens. You know, that's how it works. So, the terminology Hegelian dialectic comes from a guy named Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. And to put it this way, he was Karl Marx before Karl Marx was Karl Marx, if you know what I mean. He's sort of like the original gangster of communism. And in fact, when Karl Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto, it was based on Hegel's work. So and what Hegel believed was that the population must be ruled by a centralized government and any and all individualism must be eliminated for the greater good. That doesn't sound like much fun, but I would say that it sounds a lot like where we're going, and we're starting to see that, become more prevalent in the fact that the government wants to centralize as much power as they can and reduce our individual freedoms and ability to speak and challenge them and all those things. That's what tyrannical governments do. They have some power. They want more power, and they of course always fear the people. And the reason why they fear the people is because they're always up to no good. I mean, the government is up to no good, and so you have to worry about the people that are supposed to keep you in check. So they want to silence them and create sort of like a two class system. And I would say that we have that in the United States. We certainly have a two class justice system. And that's for damn sure. The thing that makes the Hegelian dialectic and the problem-reaction-solution concept so efficient and so effective is that we are typically good people, and we want good things for other people. And so when there's a crisis, we want a solution that protects us.
Right.
And psychopathic governmental rulers, they realize this, and they take advantage of that because they know how we think. They know that what we're looking for is to protect ourselves, protect our families, to save our brothers and sisters, and to protect humanity. They're destroyers of humanity, so they see this as a golden opportunity for them to get in there and start monkeying around with the way things work, under the guise of providing us a solution so that this horrible thing never happens again. Of course, the horrible thing always happens again because they run the same play over and over and over again because it's effective and it works. But there's a tendency for us sane and rational people to assume that everybody that we interact with is also sane and rational. And, maybe just call it giving others the benefit of the doubt, whatever you want. But it's not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, the world needs more of that, I would say. But they know that, and they leverage that. And there's a downside to being overly trusting, and that's that those with bad intentions can operate with impunity and, use the trust of others to their advantage. A person that's up to no good will use those people to get what they want. That's just life. That's just the way it works. All right, let's take a break for just a minute so I can tell you about our two sponsors. Scribd offers unlimited ebooks, unlimited audiobooks from major publishers, and unlimited magazines, all for $9.99 a month. It's a great deal. You can actually sign up for 30 days for free, no charge. Cancel whenever you want if you don't like it. It's an amazing resource. It's a lot cheaper than Audible. They offer unlimited amounts of information here. If you're like me, you geek out with this sort of stuff. To be able to have access to all these audiobooks, regular books, and everything. If you're into conspiracies, if you're into JFK, if you're into aliens or Bigfoot, or, the sinking of the Lusitania, it's all in there. They've got all sorts of information on that. So check out Scribd. If you like it and you sign up for it, it benefits the show directly. We do appreciate that.
But also, if you're into that sort of stuff, you're probably, like me, way into documentaries. I geek out. I've seen everything there is to see on Netflix, it seems like. And what's great about CuriosityStream is that you have access to literally thousands of documentaries. Award-winning types, exclusives, originals. You can watch them anywhere. You can cancel your service anytime. It comes in high-definition quality. There's unlimited streaming of thousands of shows. You can stream it on your laptop, your TV, your phone, your tablet. You can even view it offline. It's $19.99 a year or $2.99 a month. That is a small price to pay for acquiring additional information. If you're listening to this podcast, then you are interested in non-traditional information. You're seeking it out. Go take a look at CuriosityStream. The link is in the description box below. You sign up with them, it directly benefits the show. We certainly do appreciate that. Thanks for supporting our show, and thank you for supporting our sponsors as well.
Just because you and I wouldn't do something bad to another human being doesn't mean that other people wouldn't do it. And you know, evil people, psychopathic people, they don't have the internal governor in their brains that sends the alarm, you know, to let them know that perhaps what they're doing is not such a good thing. It's broken. It's defective. They don't have that portion of their brain. They don't have the empathy. The empathy is removed from them. And when you have no empathy, then what that does is it creates a situation where you have no barriers. There's no line you won't cross. Because if you can't imagine what it feels like to do something bad to another person, then that frees you up to commit all sorts of unspeakable acts. Just because as a psychopath, you just can't feel their pain. It must be a horrible way to live. But those that are psychopathic, to them, it's normal. In fact, they see us as weak. In fact, not only that, they see themselves as the people that have, as the strong ones that have come in to do all the dirty work that needs to be done, but the rest of us soft people won't do. And so in their minds, they're cleaning up society. They're cleaning up the world. They're helping. They're weeding out the sick and broken parts so that society will rise up. This is what Hitler talked about when he talked about, you know, getting rid of the undesirables or the handicapped, mentally ill, because it was all under, you know, all under the guise of protecting and strengthening the Reich. And if we've got these weak links, then all they're doing is draining resources, be they financial or, you know, emotional or whatever, effort resources. And if you're dedicating that time and effort and money towards these people that are crippled and mentally inferior, then what you're doing is you're bringing down the whole society in his mind. And so that's how psychopaths think. You know, we got to thin out the herd, and they love that. That's why you get guys like Prince Philip saying that if he were to die and be reincarnated, he wishes that he would come back as a human virus so that he could wipe out half the population. I mean, that's not going to go on a Christmas card, I don't think, but that's how these people think. They think like that. The fact that they actually say it publicly is alarming, and maybe that goes toward, maybe that's why Prince Andrew felt that it was a good idea to do that interview and talk about Epstein, because it runs in his family that they have no ability for self-reflection, or they have no idea how their words are going to be perceived by the rest of the people. But anyway, this is the byproduct of a psychopathic mentality where you not only do you not see yourself as being evil, you see yourself as the hero coming in to do the necessary make the hard decisions and the tough, you know, the tough decisions to take care of this problem that they've got, because in order to, you know, raise your society or keep your maintain the level that your society is at, you feel like you have to weed out all these inferior people. It's for the betterment of everyone. But that's crazy talk. I mean, that's how insane people see the world. But unfortunately, those are the people that rise to positions of power, because when you're psychopathic, you want to control people. And what better place, but what better way to control a person than to get into government, a job whose entire purpose is to control other people. So when you're thinking about how psychopaths work, and it always reminded me of the allegory of the scorpion and the frog. Have you heard that before? A scorpion and a frog meet on the bank of a stream, and the scorpion asks the frog to carry him across the stream on his back. So the frog says to the scorpion, "How do I know you won't sting me?" And the scorpion says, "Because if I do, I will die too." So the frog is satisfied, and they set out, you know, across the stream. But midway there, the scorpion stings the frog. And as the frog starts to feel the onset of the paralysis, it starts to sink. And knowing they will both drown, before they go under, the frog says to the scorpion, "Why?" And the scorpion's response is, "It's my nature. We are the frogs. They are the scorpions. We can make ourselves crazy trying to understand how they think and why they think the way they think. But in the end, I think the easiest way to look at it is it's just in their nature. Scorpions are going to scorpion, you know? They're going to sting you. Not because they're bad people, although I would make an argument that a lot of them are bad people, but at their core, they're just scorpions. They're just psychopaths. They're just not wired the way we are, and therefore, they can't help themselves. You can't change them. I'm not going to go in there and fix somebody. Are you going to sit down and have a conversation with Prince Philip and try to explain to him that it's not nice to want to come back as a virus and kill half the population? He wouldn't understand you. You know, maybe that's the reason why we're constantly disappointed. We keep expecting them to be frogs, and then they act like scorpions. And, you know, we put them on our back. We start across the river only to be, you know, reminded halfway through the journey of who they really are. Philip K. Dick said, "The basic tool for the manipulation of reality is the manipulation of words. If you can control the meaning of words, you can control the people who must use the words." And Philip K. Dick would know. He was great at using words to paint a picture. But you know who else was pretty good at that was George Orwell. And in his book 1984, there's the famous term: "War is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength." And we kind of laugh at that, you know, because it's so backwards that how could you ever, you know, believe that? Well, I feel like we're slipping closer to 1984, in part because we have people trying to control our words, trying to control what we say, the words that we use. In 1984, they would memory hole the words, meaning put them down this chute, and the words would disappear. And their language, new speak, is what they called it, as opposed to old speak, was as what they described as the only language that gets smaller every year. They would take words away. And it's kind of like what we're doing. We're taking words away. There's certain words that are off limits, or that have been deemed to be off limits by people that think they're doing the right thing, but are actually probably, you know, constraining their own ability to communicate by doing that. They won't figure this out anytime soon, maybe ever. But that's what they're doing. The words are powerful. That's why the media is so important in this whole reality that we live in. And you know, that you can say something like George W. Bush said, they hate us. They hate our freedoms, our freedom of religion, our freedom of speech, our freedom to vote and assemble and disagree with each other. I mean, this statement is so preposterous on a variety of levels. But first of all, don't flatter yourself. You know, they don't give a flying fuck about our freedoms. They've got their own problems in Afghanistan and Iraq and Somalia and Yemen. You think they sit around for 2 seconds thinking about us? I don't think so. They're worried about their families. They're worried about food. They're worried about drone strikes on school buses and then getting hit an hour later once the first responders aren't. These are real things that they need to worry about. These are the real things that they can hate us for. But our freedoms? How did my freedoms wind up in Afghanistan? I thought my freedoms were in the United States as an American. So you have to go to the Middle East to defend my freedoms? My freedoms were fine until you started defending them. Thank you very much. It's created nothing but problems. But, you know, if you turn on Fox News back with the buildup to the Afghanistan invasion and the Iraq invasion in 2003, I mean, they would have you believing that entire countries were running, you know, 24/7 hate factories where, like, an assembly line of terrorists were working on dry erase boards trying to come up with new and creative ideas and how they could destroy America, you know, like skipping their bathroom break so that they could come up with a couple more concepts and ideas of how to take our freedoms. I mean, none of this stuff was really happening. They didn't hate us for our freedoms. They hate us now, and for damn good reason, because we've been killing their kids for 2 decades. I mean, can you blame them? The question isn't, why do they hate us? The real question is, why are we supposed to hate them? You know, the people in Iraq and Afghanistan, they didn't have anything to do with 9/11. They were framed for that by the American media and the American government. And, you know, that's the same government, by the way, that lies to their own people as a matter of standard operating procedure. Why anybody would listen and believe a State Department briefing is beyond me. I mean, how many times do you have to be busted lying before the viewers tune you out? But it seems like they just keep going and going and going. Like there's no reason for them to stop, I guess. And part of that is, you know, sort of the dumbing down of the American populace. You know, whether it be through watching television your whole life or getting a poor education or fluoride in the water or eating GMO foods or getting poisoned with vaccines or whatever. I mean, America is so dumbed down. Look, and I take no pleasure in saying that as an American. I don't like the idea of that, but we have to be objective about it. I mean, go to Walmart, right? Just go to Walmart and walk around. And tell me if we look like a society that's excelling at very much. What the government and the media has done in the United States is divide us into us and them, and that's not accidental. You know, the relationship between the public and the government, be it politicians, police officers, federal agents, TSA, you know, it's changed over the last generation. There used to be a feeling that we were all on the same team, like working towards the same goals and, you know, stronger in our unity. But I don't think many Americans feel that way. I haven't felt that way in a long, long time. Back in the 80s, the idea of us versus them was usually framed as United States versus Soviet Union. But once the Soviet Union split apart, then the United States needed, you know, a new them to have a problem with. And for the, you know, the most part, they created the boogeyman known as Al-Qaeda. And more recently, the ever popular fire-breathing, kitten-strangling ISIS, which is a product of Western intelligence. It's literally the Israelis had their turn was ISIS back in the 80s. Israeli secret information services. I mean, that's what they called it. They called it ISIS. So, and the Al-Qaeda, just so you know, the Al-Qaeda, the translation translates to the base. And what does that mean? It's the database. It's the database of all the freedom fighters that the United States had during the 80s, during the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, that the United States financed and funded and organized to fight against the Soviets. That's Al-Qaeda. That's the base. That's who we're fighting against. These people, these terrorist boogeymen that are operating throughout the world, operating against the United States, are created and funded by the United States. That's the big secret. That's the thing that they don't want you to know about. They don't want you to know about that on the on the nightly news. And lately, with what happened in Syria, it's hard to keep track of who's on your side anyway, because it's like, whoa, ISIS in Syria. Well, wait a second. They're on our side. Yeah, we like them. They're okay, but we don't like this version of ISIS. I mean, they've lost the plot. They've gotten themselves so confused that nobody can tell who's on the team. They've got, there are literally factions fighting against each other in portions of Iraq and Syria that are both being funded and supplied by the United States. They're funding both sides. They're fighting each other. What are we doing? What the fuck are we doing? We're creating chaos, you know? And if you don't rightly fall in line and support the troops, then you will be branded as unpatriotic, which is another word that they like to throw around and slap on people, slap that label on somebody, and next thing you know, you're unpatriotic. Like, you don't support America? Like, what's the matter with you, man? And, well, I don't know. Maybe I've thought this through. I'm not just going to go put a love it or leave it sticker on the back of my truck. You know, what are we doing here? What are we doing? The enemy, what we're seeing now, which is alarming, of course, is that the soldiers that have that were sent off to Afghanistan in Iraq and did combat tours, multiple combat tours, and came back with their heads all scrambled, the VA unfunded, unwilling to take care of them, shooting themselves, you know, a dozen soldiers committing suicide every day. What's the thanks that they got for going and fighting these terrorists? They got labeled as domestic terror threats themselves when they came back. And the reason was because they were good at handling weapons and explosives. Well, no shit. You trained them. You turned them into soldiers and sent them over to fight for you. And then when they come back, they still have those skills. And now what? They're domestic terrorists because of this? Why would anybody sign up for the military knowing this? I'm not trying to say that everybody in the military is a bad person. Most of the people in the military are just following orders. That's a problem in and of itself. But don't you understand that they create a boogeyman to destabilize the Middle East? They send all of our troops over there to fight these bullshit wars. Then when they come back all messed up, and understandably so, they then become the enemies. Thanks a lot. You know, that's a hell of a recruiting pitch you got there. I guess that explains why they have to spend, you know, millions and millions of dollars creating video games like the Army did and the Marines have to use as recruitment tools to get kids fired up to join the military, because the people that have already joined the military and have come back, they're not going to be singing your praises after they can't get their medication from the VA, or if they do, they go to Walter Reed Hospital and there's cockroaches and you know, unmopped floors everywhere. I mean, this is the reality. Oh, by the way, we've also spent close to $6 trillion on these wars, if you count future liabilities that will be calculated into it. So everything about it has been a disaster. But it all came about because of 9/11 and the words that these politicians used, how they fueled us and they got us fired up. And, you know, we got to go get them there before they come back and get us here and all that stuff. And we'll get into 9/11 in future episodes, because that's a can of worms. But the point of that is that the justification for these wars are always based on lies. And the lies, if you boil it down, are nothing more than the words that come out of the politicians' mouths. Manly P. Hall is an author, and he wrote that words are potent weapons for all causes, good or bad. He's right. Actually, David Icke said something similar. He said, humans are so funny, so much moralizing about words, while at the same time thinking it perfectly moral to pepper bomb cities full of people to protect them from violence. he's nailed it. It's the war on terror. The war on terror is a war of terror. It's all about the terminology that they use. You know, lately, the general public has been conditioned to feel that we are somehow beneath the government. I mean, never mind the fact that the government is supposed to work for us. Clearly, they do not, or they at least do not feel that way. But the people are treated as if, you know, they're just a pack of idiots herded like sheep through airport security lines with their shoes off, their belts in their hand, their triple X extra large pants falling off their fat asses while they're slamming a 72-ounce, you know, Mountain Dew. It's just a lack of respect from the government towards the people. And they treat the public like they're a bunch of children, and the governments are the parents. As people, we deserve better than this. But then you see the videos of Black Friday, where all of these morons are lined up at a Best Buy at 4 o'clock in the morning, the doors open, and it just turns into a slugfest, where 70-year-old lady's getting punched in the face so that some asshole can get a 52-inch television set for $40. You know, maybe we're getting exactly what we deserve. Maybe we need to earn some respect. Maybe we need to act a little bit differently. Maybe this is at least in part on us, you know? Maybe we need to change our behavior because, you know, when you see things like that, you kind of can't blame the government for not taking us seriously, you know? Our behavior. We have to accept responsibility for some of our actions, and we have to raise our level if we think, you know, in order to earn some respect. I mean, that, you know, I'm no fan of the government. I think that's fairly obvious, and anyone that has read the books that I've written will figure that out fairly early on. But it's not for nothing, you know. I didn't just wake up one day and decide that I'm not a fan of the government. It's watching these things play out year after year after year. I mean, David Icke has a good, in Spain, they have the running of the bulls, you know, in Pamplona. I would say in the United States, we have the running of the sheep. You know, it happens every Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving. Just an embarrassment on humanity. But David Icke has a funny quote about that. He says, "We laugh at sheep because sheep just follow the one in front. We humans have out-sheeped the sheep because at least the sheep need a sheepdog to keep them in line. Humans keep each other in line, and they do it by ridiculing or condemning anyone who commits the crime, and that's what it's become of being different." I mean, there you go. You remember after 9/11, you'd see all those bumper stickers that say, "Never forget"? Well, I think there should have been another bumper sticker that said, "Never forget how unbelievably stupid Americans in large groups can be." Because we really do it. We really have, we've out-sheeped the sheep, as Icke says. We've gone from a country of big dreams and new ideas to a country of motorized scooters and bad decision makers. Circumnavigating the local Walmart like Magellan with cankles and compression socks and an oxygen tank. Just an embarrassment, you know. We need to take some responsibility for our own actions. Can't expect the government to treat us with respect if we don't even respect ourselves. But if you want to get the truth, if you want to hear what it really is, you got to go to the comedians. You know, you got to hear what they have to say, because back in the old days, the king would have his court jester, and the court jester would say the things that everybody was thinking, but they weren't allowed to say. But he would do it in a way with a smile on his face and make the king laugh. But there was truth in it. There was always truth in it. And Bill Hicks was a comedian. In case you don't know, Bill Hicks was a comedian. He died in the 90s from cancer. And he was, and he's not Alex Jones, by the way. But he had a good take on it. This is what he said: "Go back to bed, America. Your government has figured out how it all transpired. Go back to bed, America. Your government is in control again. Here's American Gladiators. Watch this. Shut up. Go back to bed, America. Here is American Gladiators. Here are 56 channels of it. Watch these pituary retards bang their fucking skulls together and congratulate you on living in the land of freedom. Here you go, America. You are free to do what we tell you. You are free to do what we tell you." Oh, man. So if the goal of these people in power, of the New World Order, let's call them, is to control the entire planet, and I believe that that is their plan, they're going to need to know where the pressure points are, so that this small group of people can bring the world to its knees. You know, in a broad sense, this requires control of information, but, you know, that can be broken down further. You know, the eight tentacles that I talked about in the book: military control, governmental control, covert control, physical control, financial control, media control, spiritual, and scientific. That's how they're going to control this world. That's how they're going to do it. They're going to do it piece by piece until we've got no power left. You ever get a fortune cookie when you go out to eat a Chinese restaurant? There's one that says, "May you live in interesting times." And it's always a cool one to get, right? And you think, oh, that's a neat way to think of it. Yeah, we do live in interesting times. That's a great fortune to get. I hope we do live in interesting times. But if you dig into the background of where that fortune came from, what you find out is that, as far as the Chinese were concerned, that fortune was meant to be a curse.